This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, to over 70 community stations around the nation. This is Word for Word, coming to you from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy.
Welcome family, friends, fans and fiends to our third edition of Word for Word. Thank you for tuning in today. I'm Benjamin Norris and this is a 16-week series where you'll get to know Australia's biggest LGBTI influencers. Each week, we will sit down with those who have inspired us, entertained us, but mostly they've made an impact on the queer community. Today, our guests are two of Australia's most famous lesbians. Can I say that?
That's absolutely fine.
They have been prolific in the campaign for marriage equality, quite visible throughout the plebiscite, and they've been championing equality right into Parliament House. You would have seen them in the news, both leading the charge with Magda Thorpe and Sally Rugg. Not only are they out and proud, but both have waved the flag for lesbians right across Australia, proving that love is love. You may know one of these girls as the younger sister of former Prime Minister Tony Abbott, but you should know her for her work with the City of Sydney. Her partner, not one to be in the shadows, works in the health industry and has raised countless amounts of money for charities including the St. Martin Foundation. Welcome to the studio, Christine Forster and Virginia Edwards.
I knew that the love I had for Christine was something that I couldn't live without.
The campaign for same-sex marriage has many faces.
Christine Forster is a Sydney suburban mum of four.
And one of the most high-profile is the Prime Minister's sister.
With her partner and fiancé, Virginia Edwards.
There was never any opportunity for me to pursue a same-sex relationship.
Well, it's so exciting to be able to have you both here in the studio, Christine Forster and Virginia Edwards.
And Virginia is no longer Virginia Edwards, in fact, because she's just recently changed her name back to her maiden name.
What was your maiden
name?
That's
a scoop for you, Ben.
Yeah, you're the first one.
I'm getting the exclusive.
Oh, well, once I tell you what my maiden name was, you're going to think, what the heck was she thinking? My maiden name is Flitcroft.
As in flitting like a little butterfly.
And where's that from? Where's the heritage of that?
It's Irish.
It's Irish.
Well, I don't think that's uncommon. I think there's a lot of Australians who have a bit of Irish in them. But getting into your backgrounds, but you both grew up in New South Wales. Was there a bit of similarity between the different upbringings that you had?
Well, not really. Virginia had a more interesting young life than mine, because mine was a pretty ordinary Sydney suburban upbringing on the North Shore. It's regarded as one of the more affluent parts of the city. My father was an orthodontist, so, you know, we were comfortable and lived a pretty ordinary and boring existence. But when I look back on it now, I sort of view it through rose-coloured glasses. It always seems to have been sunny when I was a little kid, running around playing in the bush, and because we always lived in houses that backed onto national parks. So, it was a pretty idyllic upbringing. But Virginia's was a bit different because her father was a publican.
Yeah, so one of seven children. A lot easier to buy a hotel and put us all in than to buy us an eight-bedroomed house. No, actually, he's a fifth-generation publican, so I always grew up in hotels until Mum and Dad eventually bought a house in Beauty Point in Mossman. But by then I'd left home and so forth. So yes, I had a great life growing up in hotels, putting stones in men's beers when they weren't watching and dropping chewing gum into their, you know. And Dad would say, John, the kids are out there doing it again. But it was fun.
It's such a big family. Yeah. But what sort of a role did you play?
So I've got two older sisters and four younger brothers. And being that third child is always the sort of the favoured position in the hierarchy. You're the one who gets away with whatever they feel like, and you're the happy-go-lucky one. My two older sisters, we were six under the age of six, so it was quite tight. I always had a cricket team or somebody to play football with. There was always somebody else around in the house. I tend to hang out more with my brothers than my sisters, just because of the age demographic, I suppose. But yeah. It was a great childhood. I loved it.
And Christine, where did you fit into the dynamics of your family, the Abbott family? An interesting family.
Yes, it is an interesting family. Well, I'm the youngest of four. My brother, the former Prime Minister, is the oldest of us, and I have two older sisters in between. So in my family, there was kind of the big kids. That was my brother and my oldest sister, Jane, who are only about a year apart in age. And then there was a couple of years to me and my other sister, Pip, who we kind of thought of ourselves as the little kids. So there was the big kids and the little kids, and the little kids kind of hung together and the big kids hung together.
And is that sort of relationship that you've got with your siblings now, has that sort of changed over time?
No, I don't think you can change that in families. Family dynamics are set at birth. Although I often do wonder about how the different personalities would have turned out if you mixed up the birth order.
I think maybe you might have been the Prime Minister of the country.
Yeah, and he would be a Sydney councillor.
Interestingly, if you look at a family dynamic, the first child is always, you know, the leader. The second is the one who's not too sure. The third is the one who's happy-go-lucky. And then the fourth becomes one again. So there's only really four. So Christine and Tony actually have very similar personalities because of their hierarchy in the family.
Is that interesting to look in on those roles, being that you're Christine's partner? You'd be able to notice some of those similarities in the dynamics of the Abbott family, right?
I certainly see very strong similarities between Tony and Christine, with varying viewpoints on quite a few important issues. They've got a very good moral compass, both of them. They certainly stand up for what they believe in, and they're not frightened to you know, take it to the wire and just run the whole race with it, which I find a very admirable trait.
Well, I mean, you can see why you'd be attracted to a person like that, couldn't you?
Yeah.
Because I'm hot too.
So, look, we will talk about your first relationships a little later, because you both married men and had families in your younger adult lives, but then you discovered your sexuality and found each other. But what changes did you notice within yourselves from being a young person and then to discovering that you're gay? Do you think your sexuality threw you off course in any way?
Me coming out in my later years, I think I just reached a point. Well, firstly, I met Christine, changed my world for what it was and what it had been previously. But for me, it was probably something. I think nobody could honestly say that they've never, during some point in their life, not been attracted to somebody of the same sex. And so, yeah, maybe we all had it in us when we were younger, but I think for me it was that meeting Christine that changed my world. And I don't think it, I don't know, I can't speak for Christine. What are your thoughts?
When I came out, the major thing that changed for me was that I was able to be authentically me. Now, I know that sounds a bit cliched, but I mean, I came to the realisation about my sexuality over a long period of years, probably starting in my 30s. But it was really, I mean, when I reflect back on it, on my life now, particularly my younger life, I have spent all of my life falling in love with women, that none of the women that I fell in love with over the course of my life were gay. So those relationships just remained, you know, I had very strong connections with them, but they were always platonic relationships because none of those women were lesbians.
I like the fact, though, that, you know, you've stayed true to yourself. Like, you know, yes, people can be impacted by the change, you know, coming out, by the coming out process, that can change people, but you've stayed strong. Well, you've stayed true to yourself.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, for me, it was all about being true to myself. You know, I had to come out because, you know, I'd fallen in love with and deeply passionately in love with Virginia. And that meant that I had to come out, and also sadly meant that I felt compelled that I had to end my marriage.
How old were you when that happened?
In my early 40s. Mm, yeah.
What's interesting about the fact that you both went through this was, I guess, you could be there for each other through that, and you were going through something so personal but so similar.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. You know, we were both in 20 plus year marriages, and we both had children. I had two children, Christine had four, and so our decisions had this tsunamic ripple effect on so many other people's lives.
One of you was quoted saying this, you know, to raise the children the way you wanted to have them be honest and true to themselves, you had to set that example.
Well, it was something that I felt very deeply, was that I couldn't, that I had to be honest with myself and with the people who I love. And I had to be honest with my now ex-husband, my husband at the time, that I just couldn't remain married because, well, I had... you know, unexpectedly fallen in love with somebody I wasn't married to.
Always a problem in a marriage.
It certainly is. Although it's not unique for people to remain in marriages, you know, under those circumstances, but it just was something that I couldn't contemplate, was to remain in the marriage under.
I don't think either of us could have, though. We're not that type of individual where we could think that that would be an honest and true thing to do.
Honourable way to live. And that's what then, obviously, the compulsion then was that I had to end my marriage, and the same outcome for her. So it was a very, very difficult period and a very, very terrible time for everybody involved. You know?
I don't necessarily feel like, you know, those sort of ripple-on effects ever sort of go away either. Like, those emotions that you had and the scars that we wear in anyone's lives when things like that dramatically change, they're always with us.
Yeah.
But what about the family now? Like, I think as in how are your children, are they... Well, now that you're kind of like Brady Bunch meets the Partridge Family.
Yeah, very much so. Can any of our children sing? Yes, your two boys can.
Yeah, the boys can. And I'm a fabulous singer.
Yeah.
A singer of note and karaoke. Yeah, of note. I think we've been very fortunate that the three girls are the oldest in the family, and then we've got the three younger boys. So the natural thing was that the boys were going week on, week off. They'd spend a week as three of them together with Christine and I, and then a week back with their... their fathers. And I think considering what has been asked of these kids, it's been pretty amazing.
They are six beautiful children, and they're living very successful, young adult lives now. I mean, there's no doubt about it, Ben. Any family that goes through a marriage breakdown, that has very serious impacts on everybody involved. But I think our children... very happy, very successful, and they're making their own way in the world in their own way.
Yeah. But you know what's interesting? Like, I came from a family that split up, and my mum only spoke to my brother and I as adults about her process, and that was really interesting for us, because a lot of the time when I look at other people who've had a broken family or a broken home, there was a bit of a struggle with that. But I think because my mum was so honest about that, that really helped us with it as well.
Mm.
Did you have those adult conversations with them? Because, I mean, was the youngest?
Matthew would have been six.
He was under 10.
He was six.
Virginia's not very good with years and age.
It's never six going on seven.
No, he was a bit older. Well, actually, maybe he was about that.
Yeah, he was, actually. Yeah. And look, I think you're quite right. We were very open and frank with the children.
Yep.
And for me, if I look at it now 10 years down the line, and I look at these amazing children with a completely different perspective on the world that they would not have been given or experienced had it not been for what we've asked of them. And I think it's made them, a more compassionate and...
Oh, certainly they're more... I think they are more open-minded and more, probably more self-aware.
Yeah.
I think when this stuff happens, I think it really does impact people in a way, but it's also made both of you almost a bit superhuman. It makes them a little bit more superhuman in a way that you've both been challenged by something, they've also been challenged, and they've been able to come out of it. I know that it sounds strange, but I always feel as though that makes a person richer in some way.
And I think that's true of our children, that they are stronger than they would have been because of the experiences that they've had.
I also think I look at our boys and I look at the people that they've been introduced to through our lifestyle.
Mm.
And I'm thinking, if we don't have somebody over who is, a gay couple and a gay friend, or we don't meet people going out at least three times a week, the boys feel, oh, gosh, I've been ripped off this week. So, and they were gorgeous. All of our...
Why are we eating in two nights in a row?
We have Matthew, the youngest, was a bit of a card. When he was younger, we had groups of very dear friends. And so Shane and Andrew became the Shandrews, and Sean and Paul became the Pawns, and on it went. So each couple had their own specialised name that was attributed to them. And I thought that was just showing that level of acceptance that the boys had.
Yeah,
that
absolutely.
This is just completely their normal lifestyle, which was great.
Did any of them get challenged at all through the process by, like, other people maybe?
No, not that I'm aware of.
And they didn't come and tell that to you anyway?
No, none of my children have ever said that they had been, bullied at school or anything like that because of who their mother...
You are, yeah.
And the things that I was doing in the public domain, campaigning or, standing for election, doing whatever I'm doing. Not one of them has ever reported back to me any kind of experience like that. And in fact, Matthew, who's the only one that's still at school, I mean, I think that, he keeps in very close touch with what's going on in current. He's very engaged in current affairs, and he often knows what I'm doing even before I know what
before
I'm doing
I found
it.
Out.
because he's a bit of a news hound and he follows the news, so he's right on the ball. Yeah.
You know what? I think that there's so many people out there which would have experienced things the same way that you both have. And in a way, by you being able to talk about this today, and it's raw and it's hard and it's emotional, but I think it is a bit like your trailblazers in a way, because previous to this, people didn't talk about what happens to the dynamics of their family. If one of the parents turns out to be gay and then they have a relationship, I mean, it just didn't happen.
But it's not so much that we've blazed any trail. It's more that, I suppose,
it was in a public
space. Our experience and, you know, what happened to us hadn't been, that sort of thing hadn't really been publicly aired before, I don't think. You know, here are these two women, you know,
fell in love at the school gate type scenario. Yeah.
Living in the conservative Catholic North Shore, you know, all of a sudden, you know, and me being the related to the then very high pro and still very high profile national public figure, I guess it just sort of shone a light on those kinds of situations and the fact that they happen, and they happen in unexpected places.
I'm sure there are still hairdressing salons in St. Ives that are both. Oh my God, Troy, did you hear?
Did you?
About those lesbians at the local school.
There's dark times in life, and then I guess there's good times. And so, like, when we sit here like this, what's the happiest memory that you both have of now having this family together?
I think we're pretty lucky 99.9% of the time, aren't we? Yeah. Mm. Aside from smelly shoes around the house, we've got a pretty great life. You know, we've got kids that are happy and balanced and have come through this, you know, with a certain level of resilience that I didn't know that they had within them. And Chris and I have a fantastic life, you know. Yes, albeit that we were outed publicly on a four-page spread in the Oz, that was pretty confronting, where you have to go up to your general manager and your colleagues and say, look, you know, my private life is just that, it's my private life. But as of Monday, I'm publicly outed, and, you know, there might be press and media involved in this, and I just need to let you know this. And I've got to say, in my work situation, nobody blinked an eye.
Isn't that great, though? Yeah. And it's so much... I know that's the same story I have for me with my own sexuality. I remember being so scared of thinking, oh, I can't go to grandma and grandpa's for lunch once I've come out, because what'll they think of me?
They won't accept me. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Or I'd be like, oh, couldn't be friends with the guys from school anymore because they're not going to accept me. And step by step, nobody changed. And that's what I try and tell people. The hardest day is going to be the courage that you take to tell someone. And then after that, you will be so surprised how Australia is these days, you know?
And Australia is even more so since the 15th of November.
And we're going to get into the plebiscite because we need to talk about that. But could I ask, what did you both study at school?
Oh, well, I went to university. I studied economics. I was going down a path where I should have become an accountant, an auditor.
You don't seem like an accountant.
No, I was saved from a career in audit.
No disrespect to auditors out there listening. We love you all.
Yes, they really do very important work. But anyway, I didn't end up going into accountancy, and I started work as a journalist when I was in London in the mid-1980s. And I've been a journalist all my career.
How did you find yourself in politics, working for Better Outcomes in jobs like the City of Sydney?
Okay, well, politics was... I was involved in student politics when I was at Sydney Uni, briefly, a couple of years. But then I kind of... Well, unfortunately, my running mate was tragically killed in a car accident, and that sort of, you know...
Changed things?
Yeah, it meant that I just had no, you know, heart for it after that, because he and I had been sort of a team. And then, of course, I left uni, I went overseas, went travelling, ended up meeting my ex-husband shortly before I was supposed to return to Sydney, so I ended up staying in London and was there for 7 years. And then when we came back to Australia, I was pregnant with my first baby. And so I kind of, we landed here, we had to live with my parents because we couldn't afford to buy a house. Well, that was challenging.
I bet.
And I was in this pattern then of having babies, and my children.
What a bizarre pattern!
It was
had you not worked out how it happened?
Yeah. For that generation as well, that's the Australian dream, right?
Yeah. Well, Puerto I was Rica. Rather than I was in a pattern. It was that part of time of my life when I was having children, and I was spacing them because I worked the whole way through. I didn't stop working when I had my children. I was able to work from home, so I worked from home full time, but I had to have the youngest baby into the local childcare centre before I could have the next one, so I could keep working. So that meant that my babies were very evenly spaced at about 2.5 to 3 years. And so as soon as they were out of nappies, they were into the local childcare centre and I was thinking about having the next one. And then when I'd finished having babies my career was sort of at a certain stage, and I started to turn my thoughts to, okay, what am I going to do with the rest of my career? Mm. At that time, I was approached to... I had become involved with local government through some volunteer work that I'd been doing and through school-based activities and what have you. And I was approached by somebody to stand in the local government elections in 2008 in Ku-ring-gai, which was where we were at the time, but I had to turn that down because at that point, you know, my personal life was imploding.
Yeah.
I had no idea where I was going to be living, no idea what was going on really, and what was up, which way was up or down. So I had to turn that down, and then time moved on. Of course, in Virginia, and I had become well established. We moved house. We ended up living here in Surry Hills, just over the road, and. The opportunity came up in 2012 to stand for the City of Sydney in the next local government election, so it was the full cycle later. And I just took a chance, threw my hat in the ring for Liberal pre-selection, won pre-selection as number two on the ticket, and managed to be the first ever second Liberal elected in the City of Sydney. So,
yeah, wow.
Yeah, and so that's how I've landed there, and then last year, of course, 2016, I was the Liberals' Lord Mayoral candidate, so which was great.
With the biggest swing, I might add.
Well, it was it was we were going against the electoral cycle was much more on the down for the Liberals in 2016 compared with 2012. We were really in the ascendancy in 2012, but I did manage to get a positive swing of about 3%, I think it was in the end. Which was the only, I'm pleased to say, because of my team and because of the great job they did, we were the only Liberal ticket in the state that went upwards in 2016.
And you might want to ask Ben, Virginia, what do you do on your birthday?
September. The local government elections are always the second Saturday of September, which is Virginia's birthday. So she ends up handing out how to votes for me all day.
You know what? It's so funny. It reminds me of my mum. My mum's, my family, but her parents always made her hand out all the ballots. Like,
yeah, that's what cards.
That's
yeah.
all she remembers, like, yeah. growing up, is her being bribed into somehow handing these things out. But you know what's interesting? It's like you've really had two careers in a way. You know, I mean, you've had a career of being a mother, which yep. I think is a job as well.
Yeah, it is.
And then you
That's ongoing.
Is there... I guess that's the thing. It's like they both must be rewarding in different ways.
Yeah. Yeah, look, I mean, I've been very lucky because being able to go into politics sort of at a later stage of life and have that opportunity has been absolutely fantastic. And it really came at personally the right time for me because, you know, I was seeking new challenges, new intellectual challenges, new, career, a change of career, and it really provided me with just the most fantastic opportunity. And I have to say, I could not have done any of it without Virginia. She is the most amazing political wife anyone could ever wish for. I mean, yes, she ends up handing out how to votes, but that is the very tip of the iceberg, I tell you.
Thanks, Ray. But it comes from believing in you. You know, I believe in what you stand for, and I believe in you as an individual. So for me, it's just a natural...
That's an extension for you.
Of course it is. When I see her achievements, I think, wow, you know, what a gal. Isn't she great?
Absolutely. It's so inspiring. And I think... You know, when I think of you, I think of you wanting to make an impact in the world, making an impact in Sydney. And, you know, in your career, you've also made a huge impact with the work that you both did with the plebiscite, which I think is just amazing. But, Virginia, for you, like, what's your journey? Because I know that you've worked on a lot of different charities.
Yeah, no, my background's nursing. I was a nurse from day dot. And then in recent, about the last 7 or 8 years, I've moved up into being a business development manager at hospital. So I'm still related loosely with health, but it's a great challenge. In fact, like a fantastic Big O and got myself there. And it's been a great job. It's a great company to work for. It's with Healthscope, so they're a very big company. And I still, if I do what I do well, get to make a change in somebody's life every day, which is...
Well, that's what you're doing. I mean, that's what that industry is.
You know, health is fantastic, yeah.
And you've got to be that person to do it. But I think that that shines through even in your relationship with each other. Mm. Like, you know, you're obviously... you care for Christine in a way that's a really strong backbone to who she is. And that comes from that natural ability and your desire to work in that industry.
Yeah, that nurturing sort of side of stuff.
Yes, Virginia is much more nurturing.
It's a shame I hadn't done mental health. That would have helped a long way, I promise you.
Christine, when your life was put under the microscope more so than the average person, when your older brother became the Prime Minister of the country, but also when it became clear to the general public that your politics were divided over same-sex marriage. Clearly Tony was opposed and that became public fodder. But what exactly did Tony say when he heard about this newfound relationship and found out about your sexuality?
Well, from the outset, when I told Tony that...
In fact, he was the first...
member of my family.
Member that Christine.
When I told him, from the outset, actually, he was... he was shocked, of course. Everybody in my family was shocked. I was shocked myself in many ways. But he was shocked, but he respected that I was had found myself in a very difficult situation, and he respected the fact that I had to make some terrible decisions that would have impacts on many people. And he didn't ever judge me. He was supportive and... understanding of the great difficulties that I was going through, and that's all you ask for, really, when you're in a terrible situation of the people that you love.
Well, he's your big brother.
Yeah, I was about to say that's what people forget. You know, people see him as a member of our parliament, but in actual fact, he was just Christine's brother.
He was the leader of the opposition at the time.
Yeah, and he was just giving her advice, though, as your brother.
Yeah, that's right.
Which is about family, and you're both about family. And I think it's interesting that's the way that you... That's great that's the way you look at it.
Yeah, and what he did was offer unconditional love and support in whatever decisions I made. So, and as I say, that's all you want from anyone that you love when you're in a terrible personal dilemma and crisis, which it was. And he was terrific, and he still is to this day. You know, he really, despite all
what people think,
what all perceptions, misplaced perceptions about my brother, he really gets people. He understands the sort of human condition, and he has lived a very full life himself in terms of experience, personal experiences, and
challenges himself.
Yeah. And so he understands. He has a great deal of empathy, which you don't necessarily see, coming out in the parliament. Perhaps it's not. He doesn't look particularly empathetic, but he really does.
But in parliament, in the media, we don't really see the empathy, of course. But that is because I think, in a way, the media is our link to what we know. And I think that there is an element of what we are led to believe of Tony Abbott, your brother. It's more to, sell papers in a way. And he does seem to be villainised quite a lot. I mean, I don't know him personally. But what I want to know is, I would love to be a fly on the wall at Christmas dinner or at a Sunday lunch. And what was the debate like on marriage equality for this country?
It was reasonable. It was actually very adult, reasonable. You know, a lot of people see Tony as this whole big no campaign. And how could Christine possibly... sit at the same table with him for... I mean, that's such a juvenile way of dissecting this thing. Tony has his belief system. He doesn't not love Christine or I. He does not love and support our relationship. He has a very different view to marriage, which is absolutely fine.
So do you just agree to disagree? Do you go...
Absolutely.
Well, I remember I introduced you at Pride March in 2000... I think it was 2014, and I did this intro speech for you. And then afterwards, I had a few people coming up to me and saying a few comments about what they perceived would be the dynamics between you, your brother, as in with Tony Abbott, and there must have been some animosity, is what they believed. But I said that, that's your brother, and, between a brother and a sister, I'm sure that there's some times when you have a disagreement, but then you just get on with it.
That's right. And how many people in the world always agree with their brothers and sisters.
Well, I don't.
Yeah.
I think it'd be weird if we did.
Absolutely.
It's just that poor Christine and Tony play this out in a public forum.
In a public. And we are diametrically opposed, of course, or we have been on this issue. So that, but we do. We agree to disagree. We respect each other. And, you know, we leave politics aside
out
when
it
comes to family issues.
I just want to high five. I can't reach across the table, but I just want to high five, though, how that was handled, because I think people were chomping at the bit. I think people wanted to know,
bloodbath, yeah.
And they wanted to see the animosity or the struggle, and they wanted him to feel a certain way. They wanted you to feel. I think in some ways it felt to me like they were villainizing him, and in a way, without even knowing the facts.
That's right. Well, you know, everybody is entitled to their own opinion, and you know, he holds his beliefs based on, you know, his faith, his principles, his view of history, the way he was brought up, you know, and he's completely entitled to hold that view, and I don't challenge his right to hold that view. I disagree with him. But I think, and I disagree very strongly, and I've told him, and he knows that, and I know that he disagrees with me. But I think the important thing that Tony and I were able to perhaps model through the campaign, the marriage equality campaign, was that it's okay to have differences of opinion, but that you need to respect each other for having those differences of opinion, and they don't need to tear people apart. They don't need to tear families apart. In fact, they shouldn't. They should just be, you know, accepted and respected.
And they should unify and just say, okay.
Well, they can.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, I respect you. I disagree wholeheartedly, but I still respect your right to hold that view.
Well, that kind of leads me to sort of, was you nervous when you met Tony?
Isn't that funny? People ask me that and I think, why would you be? You're as nervous as you would be meeting any new partner's family.
I was so nervous meeting my partner's family. Well, my partner's mum lives in Bendigo and so does his brothers, but I was scared on the whole way there. I mean, Ben was singing Kylie Minogue songs and I was so terrified that I was singing along. I couldn't sing along with him, actually. But I just felt really nervous, and I guess that's normal.
It had nothing to do with who he was, you know, in his position in the world. It was more that he was Christine's elder brother that she loved and wanted him to love me. But I do remember that night. Remember when you started doing that hairstyle light? It's like an app where you put different hairdos on people.
Yeah.
You know, I've got some fabulous shots of Tony in a default.
with a blonde fro.
And they shall never, ever.
What's the fundamental difference, though? I mean, this is the last thing I'm going to ask you about your brother, because at the end of the day, you are your own person. But what's the fundamental difference, though, between your politics? Is there a way to describe that?
I would be classed as more a small L liberal than Tony. Tony would he categorises himself as a conservative.
Mm-hmm.
I don't view myself as a conservative. Hence, I don't take a conservative view of marriage, because the conservative view is that it's been an institution that has served us well and shouldn't be changed. Whereas my view as a sort of a liberal, is that, well, all of those institutions that have served society have done so because they have evolved and changed with the times. And that's why we did make this reform. And in reality is, because marriage is regarded as the conservative institution, the fact that this reform makes that institution accessible to more people is in keeping with conservative principles. So I know that's a kind of a convoluted way of saying
but different.
Yes, yeah. Saying that whereas Tony would call himself a conservative, I don't view myself as a conservative. I view myself as a progressive liberal.
But still liberals.
Yeah, liberal.
But still liberal.
I am a big L liberal.
I was about to say, on Christine's pre-selection, one of your best lines was that she's a small L liberal and a large L lesbian.
Big L lesbian.
Yeah, that went down terribly well.
I think there's something about both of your honesty that I really love. Could you say that either of you are inspired by anyone in particular?
Figures from history I've found very inspiring. But just lately, I have to say, the person that has inspired me most has been Dean Smith.
Yes.
Now, Dean Smith, and in fact...
And Warren Entsch.
Warren Entsch is a terrific fellow, and what a legend. But Dean Smith, he really has been the unsung hero of the marriage equality campaign in Australia. And he, I hope I'm not speaking out of turn, characterises himself as a conservative. And yet he was the one agent of change that enabled us to get this reform through, in the sense that he was the man that did the hard work on the legislation that came up with a bill that had bipartisan, tripartisan support. And without that, we would not have achieved a reform that would have been guaranteed to stick. There would have always been pushback. There would have always been people fighting to claw marriage back to being a man, between a man and a woman only. But if not for, Dean, we wouldn't have had the outcome that we had.
Do you both share that?
Oh, most certainly. Look, I was very taken with Dean when I met him. I thought what a gentle, beautiful man that he was. Quietly spoken, very, very, very unassuming. And yet here he is, this powerhouse of intelligence that put this together. You know, he's an amazing individual.
And an unsung hero.
Yeah, completely.
Because I feel like there's a lot of prolific people out there that you see, that you can count, that you always see that are there. But there's a lot of people that put a lot of time and effort and passion.
That's right. Dean is what senators should be. He's very hardworking. He's a great legislator. He does, you know, does all the hard yards behind the scenes. He's not, you know, a high-profile politician, but he knows his stuff and he gets it done. And he really did in this instance.
What are you guys most proud of? I think, you know, when you're looking back at everything, and not specific to family or to queer people or anything like that, you know, is there something that you both feel incredibly proud of?
That we're still together
with
six children 10 years later?
Yeah,
absolutely.
I feel proud of us as, you know, the fact that we've made it. You know,
through some pretty tough times with a lot of combinations of difficulties. I mean, you could throw the dice on any given day in our lives and there'd be something that could bring us unstuck, and it doesn't. It just makes us a better, tighter couple, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it's, I mean, it hasn't been easy. There's no doubt about it. It's been, the last 10 years have been incredibly difficult at times, but they've also been amazingly wonderful as well. And, you know, the fact that we've made it through those very trying times and challenges, and you know, I dragged Virginia through the ringer, in the sense that, you know, I drag her into public life and ask of her things.
And I'm so shy.
Yes, she's...
What an introvert that woman is. That natural red hair of hers.
I have to drag her kicking and screaming into the spotlight.
Oh, no more champagne, please.
But I do ask her to do things that I know she doesn't want to do, and that she wouldn't, she certainly wouldn't choose to do if I wasn't asking her to do it. And yet we've survived, and in fact I think grown stronger and stronger.
Yeah, absolutely.
And now, you know, we are going to be able to be married, and I'm proud of the very small part that we were able to play in what has been a very long campaign. There were so many ups and downs, you know, where there were times when we were really, really hoping that we were going to get a conscience vote, and then crash, and then you're hoping that we're going to get a plebiscite, and then crash. So there were, it was really a roller coaster.
Absolutely, I think a roller coaster through and through.
Constant building up of hopes, and then dashing, having them dashed against the rocks.
And I think, you know, in a very quirky way, Tony doing what he did for the No campaign just gave you the most marvelous platform to have a voice and advocate for the Yes campaign. So he was actually a blessing in disguise for the Yes campaign.
It's a beautiful way to look at it.
Yeah, because Christine was given this voice, she would possibly not... She would have had a voice, but not to the same level.
Well, it did enable me to, essentially, whenever Tony came out and made a statement, I was able to directly rebut.
And gosh, there was a lot of rebutting.
There was. And that, I think, was very effective, I hope. I hope it didn't turn anyone off. I hope it just... helped persuade people to vote yes, but it was
absolutely.
But it was, it did enable the Yes campaign to directly challenge what he was saying, and he is influential. So
the way I see it, though, and you're proud of this love that you have. Love isn't available for everyone. We're very lucky to find it, you know. And I've know lots of people haven't found that person, you know, to complete them in a certain way. And I think that what's beautiful about the two of you is that you have been able to find that. And then you have been able to even come in here and talk about it. And I think it gives people hope that they could find their life partner.
True.
You know, that there's someone out there to be themselves, be true to who they are, and look for their soulmate. And that's what, you know, that's...
And Australia's a better place today than it was on the 14th of November.
Looking forward now, there's always going to be new things, new challenges. Where do you think we're going to be with the LGBTI? What are we looking forward at?
More inclusive society.
Yeah.
You know, where people now rightfully are given the respect that they were due. And they're, you know, I can only speak for myself. I didn't want to be special equal or different equal. All I wanted to be was equal.
It's interesting. I felt like there was a tipping point at some point as well, where for myself personally, Mardi Gras was quite sexualized. And I feel like for a large period of time, queer people were pushing the sex forward in a rebellious way. Mm. And then when we'd shifted at that tipping point to talking about equality, that was the real change. Is that what you guys feel?
It made it sensible for me. You know, it gave who we are some sort of gravitas. Mm. That we're not all about, you know, yeah, we are a fantastic community of people, and God, who wouldn't want to have gay friends? But it made us just this, you know, this is something we deserve, and this is something that we're entitled to, and we, you know, are willing to fight for it, and we did.
But I think it, really what has happened with the result of the plebiscite and the subsequent reform in Parliament is that same-sex relationships have become mainstream.
Mm.
They have every much validity. They have the same status as everybody else's marriage. And I think that creates a fundamental shift in people's minds. I mean, people innately know that marriage is a special relationship. That's kind of inherent in people. And the fact that same-sex relationships can now be given that special status, that special validation, that special acknowledgement, makes them part of the mainstream, which they haven't been before. They've always been a sort of a second class of relationship. And that will, I think, start to pervade the psyche of the nation. I mean, it's already started, and 62% of us thought that was how it should be. But I think if we ask the question in 5 years' time, that figure will be down to 20%.
I think it's going to change.
And five years
that.
After that, it'll probably be down to the rump of about 10% of people whose minds you can just never change. But it's just that general acceptance that, you know, gay people are okay.
And they shouldn't feel any different.
They shouldn't, because they're not. They have every all the rights that everybody else does.
Absolutely.
And that will make a difference even in just the way people behave in public, you know. Same-sex couples, you know, showing each other affection publicly. I mean, we have so many friends who've been in long-term relationships, but they won't touch each other in public because they're so...
A PDA, yeah. Public display. Yeah.
My partner doesn't do PDAs. Yeah. I try to hold his hand and he snaps it away.
Yeah. And that's for a lot of people, particularly people our age, that is absolute... They would never do it because they'd be so frightened, so concerned if they...
Backlash.
You know, show affection for their partner in public, that they'd be attacked.
I don't think we got that memo, did we?
No, luckily not.
But that's a good thing, though, because you're setting the tone in a way. Yeah. Virginia, I was going to say, though, during the plebiscite, there was times where we felt that it was quite dark and at times we struggled with it. Was there anything during that plebiscite for you that you found particularly hard?
Yeah, look, I was being contacted by a lot of younger gay friends of ours who were in that sort of 18 to 25-year age band, and they were saying, you know, I just don't get it, Vee. All my life, you know, my school friends accepted me, my family accepted me, and I thought I was acceptable. But now I have people tweeting terrible things and Facebooking terrible things, and it's as if the plebiscite, for the downside of the plebiscite, and there were a few downs, it gave people license just to say whatever ugly thing they wanted to say to another human being and think that that's fine, you know, I've been given this right to do that. So a lot of these younger gay friends were saying, I don't understand it. I always thought I was okay, and now I'm doubting that I am. So that was a difficult time for me.
At the same time of it being so difficult, did you feel a part of something that was that it was growing some strength?
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, and it was an amazing time. I felt privileged. Generally, I felt privileged to be part of that. And to sit in Parliament, as we did for those 9 long hours, with no phones, no water, no food, aside from sneaking in Magda Zapansky's Mentos out of a handbag.
Cutting them in half, rationing them out.
I said, Magda, I'm living off my body fat. You look at me, darling. She said, I've got, you know, Mentos in my bag, so I snuck them in past the security.
Well, it was gripping too. Mm. I didn't want to miss any of it, really.
Mm.
And even the what became very long-winded and repetitive debate over amendments after amendments, basically all mostly supposedly aimed at protecting, you know, freedom of religion and freedom of speech and parental right, none of which has anything to do with the Marriage Act.
Well, you know, for me, excuse my ignorance with this, but I just really felt like it was so unnecessary, that process. But did it have to play out that way?
I think it did. I mean, and certainly those members who wanted to vote for the amendments, you know, they needed to make a statement. They needed to show their electorates that they had taken a stand. They needed to show their pre-selectors, in many cases, that they had taken the internal party pre-selectors, that they'd taken a stand. And they had to give that signal and they had to make a public statement. But it was clear from the outset that none of those amendments were going to be passed. The numbers just weren't there. So it was a matter of going through the process and you know, and for some of them, particularly people like Kevin Andrews, you know, it enabled them to get up and say, well, you know, I hope when we prove you all wrong that, you know, you'll admit that sort of, you know, when we say that we told you so, you'll admit it graciously kind of thing.
Now, of course, that's all on public record now. Yeah. So it's
So it was a lot of grandstanding, really. And in my view, and I'm very optimistic about this, I don't think any of the stuff, the terrible stuff that they've predicted is going to happen, will happen in Australia. Australia is not America. We're not a litigious country. People don't, you know, generally speaking, go around looking to haul people before tribunals or courts or whatever because they have a difference of opinion. It's just not in our national makeup.
But they were really they were gripping at that point. I feel as though for people who probably just felt that they wanted to vote no, didn't really have the foundation, like they really didn't have the foundation as to why.
That's right.
And it seemed to me like they were gripping at things that were laughable. In my mind.
Oh yeah, they were clutching at straws. It was any kind of tactic to delay or
muddy the waters.
Yeah, this change. But yeah, as I say, but sitting there on the day, it was gripping. I didn't want to miss any of it. I don't think I even had a toilet break all day.
9 hours.
Nine
long
hours.
Time.
She was a girl. Well, there was no water, so we're all living in severe dehydration. Yes.
But. Well, we made up for it with some champagne afterwards. But it was a very historic moment, and I was so pleased that we were able to be there because we kind of went down at very last minute. I got a phone call on the Wednesday night saying, you know, Chris, and this was from the campaign, we're doing a media event at 7 a.m. in the morning. Can you come down? We're pretty sure it's going to happen tomorrow. So it was, we just jumped in the car that, you know, an hour later and went down there. But it was wonderful to be there. It certainly was. I'll never forget it. And it was a moment of huge national significance for us to for our parliament to pass this bill to make every Australian equal. Wow, what a moment!
It's superhero stuff. Like as in, you've really proved something not only to your own families but to yourselves and to Australia.
Yeah, and stood by your principles.
Exactly.
You know, and as Warren interested to me, I said, so Warren, you know, here you are, the sort of crocodile hunting Queenslander, you know, you're a blokey bloke. I said, so, you know, the straightest man you'll ever meet in your whole life. And I said, so why did you do it? You know, why were you involved? I said, it was the right thing to do.
But it was also done with dignity. Mm. I really felt as though it was handled, I don't know, these leaders, these people that played the part were there for a reason, and it was done in a way that no one could pull it apart.
I think just on that, Ben, the campaign was so incredibly professionally run. It was disciplined. It was on message. It never frayed at the edges. Nobody got out of hand. It was controlled. It was just a very, very successful campaign. And that is thanks to the people that were closely involved. Nobody lost the plot. You know, there was of course there was a little bit of bad behaviour at the extremes from both sides.
Yeah.
But, you know, that sadly is always going to happen.
That's human nature.
Yeah, that's right. You have the extremists who are going to do the wrong thing. But generally speaking, it was an extraordinarily well-run campaign and it was so disciplined and professional. They did a terrific job.
Did Malcolm Turnbull do the wrong thing by having it play out this way?
I think history has proved that this was the right way for it to go. Although none of us wanted a plebiscite, and none of us would have chosen to have that as our process to get to this reform. What it did was put a full stop to the politicking,
mm-hmm.
because the people had spoken. The politicians couldn't refute it, which is what they would have always done. If it had just been a vote in Parliament, there would have always been pushback. The people that were standing up and voting, you know, debating amendments and voting for them, the numbers there were about, it was about 85-50 through, from memory, through the day. So you would have always had 50 versus 85 saying that we shouldn't have this legislation. That's a much bigger proportion than 38% of the population. So the politicians needed the people's verdict so the validity of the change couldn't be challenged. And once we got that result, and the only way to get it was to hold some form of plebiscite. So even though we didn't want it, it was absolutely the right way for us to get to finish this journey.
In an emotional way of looking at this, not in a factual way of looking at it, do you feel like there's a bit of backtracking now from a lot of politicians about the response?
Oh, there will be.
Oh, they don't want to be on the wrong side of history.
Is that you? That's what I believe.
Yeah.
I feel like they don't want to be on the wrong side of this now that they know that the vote was much stronger than, you know, I think a lot of them had expected.
Well, even the, you know, the very staunch opponents, like my brother and Kevin Andrews and Andrew Hastie, they abstained. They didn't vote against this legislation. So
what was that phone call like? Did you, when you ring Tony, did you say anything?
Well, on the 15th of November, within about half an hour or so of the survey result being announced, Tony rang me to say congratulations, you know, well done on it. Tony is extremely gracious, very generous-spirited. So, yeah, we had a reasonably long conversation, and then I rang him the evening of the vote in Parliament to give him my commiserations, and we had quite a long chat then too. But he did sound a little downcast. I was surprised actually at how downcast he sounded, and I don't think they were having the same kind of party in whosever office they were in Parliament House as the one that we were having in Trent Zimmerman's office.
What do you think's next? I feel like, you know, that's been done, and you know, there is a reprieve, and we feel great. But there still is quite a bit of homophobia still,
yes,
in this country that's still there. Mm. What do you think is next? Do you think that we sort of touched on it where it sort of is bleeding out in a way.
Mm. I think it's generational. I look at, you know, the school leavers of today where, you know, in James's class there's, you know, an openly gay boy at a very conservative Catholic school. And nobody blinks an eye.
I'm so jealous of that.
I know.
I want to go back to school.
You still
could. I want to be
You've
like...
You've got great skin. You can get there.
Oh, no, I'm nearly 40. This is drinking a lot of water and running.
But I think that that's what's going to change. I think that the younger generations coming through, it doesn't matter. It actually doesn't change who you are as an individual. I like you because of who you are, not because of your sexual orientation.
And that's the most important thing about this change is that young Australians who, you know, might be coming to terms with who they are can look into their future and know, well, whatever, you know, whoever I am, I can have the same opportunities, I can have the same future as anyone else because I will be able to get married. That won't be excluded, you know, from my life. So that is a really significant thing, and is a, and as time moves on, it, as Virginia says, it just becomes normality.
Correct.
It's no, you know, it's no longer odd. It's no longer thought of as being, you know, a hidden minority of people that, you know, have these relationships. It will just be as normal as the next, and that's when you get to that level of acceptance and respect, that's when you leave homophobia behind.
I want to thank you both so much for coming in. I literally could talk to you forever. Do you have a message? I'll start with you, Virginia. Do you have a message for the queer community?
I just want to say how proud I am of the gay community and LGBTIQ, trans, you know, us as a body of people are powerful.
Christine?
Yeah, look, I think that as Virginia says, we should all feel very proud of ourselves. But Australia as a whole should feel proud of itself because, you know, we got there because of the straight community. because the straight community said it's right and fair that everybody should be able to get married. And we as the gay community, or members of the gay community, should be very mindful of that.
Yeah.
That
and thankful.
Yeah. And also we need to be very mindful of the fact that there are, you know, there was 38% of people that didn't think that this was the right reform, and we have to respect them.
Mm.
And we have to try and by living the way, you know, living our lives, having our marriages, becoming part of the furniture, and not lording it over, you know,
not changing the minority from one group to another.
We don't want any triumphalism in this. No. We just want to accept that Australia as a country has done this together, and let's just be together
and set the tone.
Yeah.
You know, live our lives and be happy people.
Yeah,
and I think that's what we all need to do, really. Thank you both so much for coming in and having this chat. If people see you when they walk down the street, I'm sure they're going to give you a high five just for sharing your story today.
Yeah.
You know, I think it helps people, it inspires people, and it was the very reason why I had you here.
Oh, you're marvellous. Thank you.
Thanks for having us, Ben.
Word for Word is presented and produced by Benjamin Norris from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy. Word for Word is distributed nationally to over 70 radio stations across the community radio network.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.